Welcome to Leadership Reimagined, episode 13, where Garv Bahala, PhD consultant and author of Awakening a Leader's Soul, Learnings Through Immortal Poem, and I discuss the concept of soulful leadership and decision making. During each episode, we look at leadership from the vantage point of what it's going to take for leaders to lead their organizations forward into a new future. I'm Dr. Jane Lovis, your host. If you're looking to reimagine your leadership, I would love to help you and your team. Go to reimagineyourleadership.com and I'll call you. We'll have fun and expand your business at the same time. I know, shouldn't it be fun? If it's not, why are you doing it?
Good afternoon, Garv. How are you today? I'm so excited to have you here. And I would love for you to introduce yourself and share what you're up to.
Well, thank you very much, Jane. Very delighted to be here with you. And you want me to introduce myself? Do you want me to leave out the first 25 years of my life? And then
well, I think we might run out of recording space on my computer.
So to put it in a nutshell, you know, I think that in today's day and age of diversity and everything, I'm from India. Spent a lot of time being global long before it became fashionable to talk about being global. I've worked on 5 different continents, interacted with executives in over 30 different countries. I have those 3 funny letters after my name, PhD, permanently hysterical and delusional. So sometimes that's an advantage, sometimes that's a disadvantage. But I'm from the business world. I'm from the business world and I'm a totally demand side of the business guy. What that means is that I'm not your HR person. I'm not an IT person. I'm all about customers, competitors, products and services, technologies, everything to do with the demand side of the business that helps the business get revenues, growth, sales, etc. My major fields when I did my PhD were marketing and strategy, but I've spent a lot of time in leadership and innovation because you really can't sort of talk about marketing and strategy without leadership and innovation for the simple reason, let me give it to you in 5 clean sentences. You know, every company wants to grow. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely.
And if they want to grow, they need more and more profitable customers. And that's where marketing comes into play. But in order to get more and more profitable customers, companies have to offer them something of value. And that's where innovation comes into play because Man for All Seasons is great theater. But innovation for all times is not good business. And you can judge that for yourself. If I were to ask you to pull out a Sony Walkman from your pocket right now, you wouldn't be able to do it. Even though the Sony Walkman was all the rage just about 15, 20, 20, 30 years ago. So that's where innovation comes in. But because innovation is not deterministic, you can't put a gun to somebody's head and say, promise me that this innovation will succeed. Innovation, by definition, is probabilistic. Some innovations work, some flop, you know. And that's where strategy comes in because you have to place strategic bets. Which innovation are you going to back? Which innovations are you going to pass over? And that's where leadership comes in because that's the wisdom of leaders to say, okay, which direction is the world headed? Which direction are we headed? Which direction are our competitors headed? And what should we place our strategic bets on? And what should we fund? And what should we withhold? So if you really look at it, leadership, innovation, marketing, and strategy, they all work together around the single hub that I like to call customer value innovation. And that's really what I'm all about.
Interesting. That is so... I've never heard anybody put it that way before.
And I told you
you're
am
right.
I told you I'm idiosyncratic, so get prepared for that.
Yeah. And I got that just extra.
and the other thing that your listeners may like to hear is that I've been very blessed in having experienced the working world or the professional world from a number of different perspectives. So I've been a multinational executive, an ex-Nestle, ex-Vix, which is now P&G. I was a global innovation director for TNS. I've experienced the business world as a strategy consultant, you know, as I said, globally. I've been an executive education specialist. I've been an adjunct faculty at several leading business schools around the world, like Georgetown, Singapore Management University, Indian School of Business. And the best of all, the most that I really cherish is that I'm a published author, and not just in business. I'm also a published author in literature. I've written business books. I've written novels. I've written short stories, screenplays, poetry. So that is something I really cherish because it's been with me for a long time. So I've been very blessed to have lived a very rich life from a number of different angles.
And it was your book that connected us at a leadership breakfast. And you shared your book with me. You were in the process of finishing it up, I think, at that time.
No, I'd already finished it.
Go ahead and share the title of it.
Yeah, you're right. You're absolutely correct that the book did connect us, but I had already finished it at that time, which is how I was able to give it to you.
Ah, you're right. Yes. I knew I'd read it, and I thought I couldn't remember if I'd read it after you published it or right before as you were publishing it.
After.
And so what's the title of your book?
The title of my book
Very
is...
Very unique title.
Thank you. The title of my book is Awakening a Leader's Soul, Learnings Through Immortal Poems.
And it was a number of essays and stories on leadership. And one of the things that you wanted to talk about today, which I think comes out of that and the work that you've done, is soulful leadership.
Well, that is the theme. That's the major focus of that book, Awakening a Leader's Soul. It is soulful leadership.
Yes.
And the way it is defined is it's nothing to do with soul as in a religious sense, but in a very pragmatic sense. And that is that you cannot be a leader without making decisions. Simple as that. There's no such thing as a leader and not doing anything. You know, you have to be, if you want to be a leader, then you've got to take decisions. Now, here's the very simple thing that a lot of leaders miss. And every leadership decision requires a sacrifice. You're either sacrificing yourself, you're sacrificing resources, money, sometimes the earth, you know, or you're sacrificing people. So this whole concept of soulful leadership, which is a human-centric perspective on leadership, says that in a very complex world, in a very uncertain world, like the one that we live in, choices are not bind the choices that leaders face, to the strategic challenges that they face, cannot be solved with yes-no thinking. We don't live in a binary world.
Right.
Right, wrong, agree, disagree, correct, incorrect, black, white. Now, that is oversimplifying the world that we live in. And so when we live in a complex and uncertain world, the truth doesn't lie at either extreme. The truth lies in the murky middle. And to get into that murky middle and to figure out whom am I sacrificing and why am I sacrificing them, it is the humanity of the leader, who they are, what they stand for, what they're willing to fight for, that is infinitely more important than their executive brilliance. That, in a nutshell, is the book.
And the question is, okay, how do I do that? Because it's one thing to say, oh, that's what I'm going to do. But, you know, those murky middle questions with answers, they're, like you said, there's no simple answer.
Yeah, actually there is a very simple, that question that you ask is a tough one, but the answer to it is a simple one. Okay, so first of all, let me sort of dispel or explode or bust or decimate a myth. I'm sure you've heard the expression, so that all of us can win. You know, I'm sure you've heard that. So all of us, you know, I want to make everybody happy. Well, guess what? That is absolutely impossible. Kenneth Arrow has already won the Nobel Prize for demonstrating that the moment you go from two people in a room to three people, it is impossible to satisfy everybody's needs. You just can't do it. Mathematically, physically, it's impossible. And Jane, I know a little bit about you. So you brought up in a family, three, four, five people. People can't even agree what to cook or cook for dinner. People can't even agree what kind of movie to go for. So
right.
The moment you have more than one sibling, the moment you have two or three or four or five people, you know, it is a very pleasant accident when everybody agrees on something. But that's not the same thing as satisfying everybody's needs. So with all due respect, how does one achieve that? How does one achieve soulful leadership? Using a very single metric, simple single metric. And that is, do my decisions increase the well-being of the greatest many possible? Or am I only increasing the well-being and prosperity of the privileged and powerful few? So all the time, you're weighing. It's a weighing game. Who is benefiting?
Yep.
Who is losing? Who is benefiting? Who is losing? And if you can answer that question honestly, look at yourself in the mirror and say, you know, I'm comfortable with my decision, then that's the best that you can hope for. Because there is no perfect solution to anything. There is no ideal solution. You cannot please everybody.
Right.
It's impossible.
No, you can't even not do anything to please everybody because somebody will be unhappy that you didn't do anything.
Well, as I already told you, you can't be a leader and not do anything. That's the biggest, you know, BS that I've ever heard in my life. That, oh, let's just not do anything. Well, guess what? That is also doing something. Not doing anything is also doing something. And you're still sacrificing something or somebody.
Exactly. And every time you do something or don't do something, you're saying no to something else.
Correct.
You don't do it. But I really, that concept of maximizing the benefit, maximizing the number of who is going to benefit as a way to support you in making those decisions is really, that's powerful.
I'll give you a simple example, and I'm not going to name the company because I don't think they want to be named, but it's a very large financial services company, okay? And I was in with them. I was doing some projects, etc. And when COVID hit, the chairman made a decision that we are not going to fire anybody. Okay, that we are so they said, if we don't want to sacrifice our people, we're going to have to sacrifice all these consultants because we can't pay them and our people. If we want to retain our people, then we've got to tell these outside people to just stay outside for a while till, you know, we can get back up to full steam. Now, was I sacrificed in the process? Of course I was. Okay, were the employees sacrificed? No, they were not. So the greatest well-being and prosperity was defined by the CEO and the company as looking after their people. Nothing wrong with that. Okay. May not sit well with me, but that's a totally different matter. The point I'm trying to make to you is that it's a very simple metric. It is not that complicated, but it requires clarity of thinking. You know, it requires absolutely a fog-free brain. If your brain is fogged, you know, you're going to be all over the place.
And you have to be willing to make the decision.
Oh, of course. I mean, that's the other thing that I keep laughing at this whole thing about, you know, there's so much talk about personality and this and that and the leadership literature. But ultimately, we forget that leaders are there for one and only one thing, to move the company from point A to point B while they are leading the organization or institution or the country or whatever. They have a job to take the organization from where it is today to some future place so that they can increase the well-being and prosperity of the greatest many, not just their own. I mean, at the end, imagine this scenario. And it is actually in my book. Imagine this scenario. Let's say that a CEO has been retained and they have a contract for an 8-year term. And I'm taking 8 years because that's what the president of America is, 2 terms, 2 times 4 is equal to 8. Okay. And they're at the end of their tenure and they're leaving now. There's a farewell party for the CEO. And somebody in the audience asks the CEO, they say, "Hey, Skipper, how did we do in these 8 years? Now, imagine the CEO says, "I don't know about you, old chap, but I've got, you know, a place in the Hamptons. I've got a 60-foot yacht and I've got a place out there in southern France. I did very well. You know, I don't know about you." How will that sound? I mean, if that's the best answer that we can give, and which is exactly what the answer a lot of people give in power.
Right. You know,
I don't think we've come very far from the Stone Age. I think we're still in the Stone Age, you know. But if a leader says, "Well, you know, we were able to increase the salaries by X percent. So many people benefited. We, you know, served so many communities more. We provided so many more scholarships, etc., etc." Whatever. Okay. If they can give tangible evidence that people benefited and a greater number of people benefited than they did at the start of the journey, then that's really what says is they made the right decisions.
Yeah.
You can't get from point A to point B and not make decisions. I mean, that's impossible.
Right, right. And when you do it with, as you said, that simple metric behind you, do these decisions benefit the greatest number of people possible, have the greatest impact, then you're looking at a much bigger space of for making your decisions from, because they're not just about what's going to benefit the CEO.
Or those, as I always like to say, I don't want to just single out CEOs, because that would be totally unfair. But the way I like to put it is that those in positions of privilege and power and access to resources, if only they are benefiting.
Great. Thank you.
If only they are benefiting, then there's a problem. I mean, and again, I don't like to get into people's politics, and I don't want to sort of sound, you know, as if I am interfering. But I would. I mean, if the definition of democracy is for the people, by the people, of the people, then why is it that only millionaires and billionaires are in cabinet positions? That's certainly not for the people, of the people, by the people. You know, that's a small sliver of society. So that's what I'm trying to basically say. That, you know, who's, again, I come back to, I just want to use very simple words. Who's benefiting? Who's losing? Someone has to benefit and someone has to lose. Everybody can't gain. Impossible.
Right. And when more gain, in this particular situation, because there are going to be other situations where others gain. So
absolutely,
looking at this, and as you say, you've spread it out, you've maximized the number of people that gain, then you're also, and you don't do that without innovation, without strong leadership, without employees, people really engaged in the work that they're doing.
So you're absolutely correct. The German poet Rilke, he has a beautiful poem in which he says, "I live my life in ever-widening circles." Why? Why do we live our life in ever-widening circles? Imagine, Jane, that you had a friend who's now, let's just say, I'm just picking a number, let's just say she's 55 years old, but she's still stuck in the year when she was 25. Not a nice situation, wouldn't you say?
Right. Yeah.
Okay, but now imagine someone who has moved from 25 to 35 to 45 to 55, living their life in ever-widening circles. Don't you think you would have a really nice, pleasant evening with that person if you were to spend a time, evening with that person, having a glass of wine, or you know, just at a casual conversation, because that person has got such a richer perspective.
Yeah.
And that's what exactly what we are trying to do with leadership. We are trying to create a richer playing field. And by richer, I just don't mean monetarily, but experience,
right,
from an existential perspective, you know. And so it's not, and the only reason I went down this path, Jane, is because I just wanted to say it's not just innovation. It all starts with vision. It all starts with, what am I really trying to do as a leader? Am I just trying to feed my own people, or am I really here to fulfill a purpose? And so there's a gentleman called Zander. He's a conductor. So his name is Benjamin Zander. He's a conductor. He's a music conductor, very famous music conductor in Boston. And he has a book called The Art of Possibility. And in that, he talks about this whole notion of, okay, so what are you doing with music? And he conducts classical music. So he says, I can either go through life saying only 4% of the people like classical music, or I can say to myself, you know, my job is to try and get as many people as I can to love classical music. And that's exactly what he does. I mean, in his vision for his orchestra is passionate music making without boundaries. He says, I don't want to put a boundary around it. Let someone else put a boundary around it. And that's exactly what I am talking about in my book, is that if there is a passion to create well-being and prosperity for the greatest many, then I will lead one way. I will decide one way. You know, I will approach it. I will approach my employees, my suppliers, my communities in a certain manner. But if my desire is just to increase the, you know, ROI and the return to, you know, on shareholder investment or whatever it is, and benefit a small bunch of people who I really think are the movers and shakers, then I'm going to go another way. Very simple.
Yeah. And I love that. The conversation about vision, because that's where it all starts. You know, innovation comes out of vision, growth comes out of vision, possibility comes out of vision. You know, you've got to see something and then be able to imagine actually being there.
And the other thing is that now we are talking about it, one of the reasons, and you've known me a long time, I'm pretty sure that you can't remember all the conversations that I've had with you, but I do not like to use the words mission and vision at all, because they're so misunderstood. And most people think of mission and vision statements exactly like that, statements, as semantic exercises. Yep. I don't look at vision that. In fact, I never use the word mission at all. But I do sometimes use the word vision, because the reason I use it is because for me, it's more important to be a visionary as opposed to have a vision. Because when you are a visionary, your feet are moving in a certain way. If you have a vision, maybe you can pull out your wallet and you can pull out a card from your wallet and say, this is my vision statement. It becomes a stock. It becomes a set of words. But for me, being a visionary is much more important. Because then it says to me, I'm living my life in a certain way. And that's really what soulful leadership is all about. It's being visionary.
Yeah. And when I talk about vision, one of the examples that I give is the being a visionary and a missionary. Visionaries have those big pictures. And you're right. If it's a statement, it's probably very sterile. And, you know, you need something to put on your website. But when you're really in touch with that vision as the visionary of it, and you can share that or share your, you know, your context of what you're trying to create in the world with your employees, all your stakeholders, you know, your customers, because that's what Xander does. is he's so passionate about music, and he wants everyone else to have the opportunity to experience it. It's not, he doesn't go out talking about, you know, the music, the industry of music. He talks about the passion of music and really draws people in. And most, so many business owners talk about their business and what they do in their business as opposed to what are they trying to create and being. I love that. And who are they being? Because you're not static when you're being. You're moving towards something.
Right.
And then when you enroll your employees in helping you create that, they've got something that they're enrolled in creating, as opposed to a job and let me get these tasks done.
A little more complicated than that, but essentially in the same direction. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. It's always more complicated, but because people are complicated.
Which is why one of the best definitions of organizations was provided by Alfred Chandler in his book, Strategy and Structure. And he said, organizations are people. End of story. and people are complicated human beings. I mean, people are complicated entities. And so, yeah, organizations are people.
Yeah. And we tend to talk about organizations and businesses as a physical, inanimate entity it's like it's one entity as opposed to the combination of all the people that comprise it.
Well, I have never subscribed to the point of view that an organization is a homogenous, however you want to pronounce it, or a singular entity. I've always believed in the fact that it is a loose assembly of fiefdoms, you know, and networks.
Yeah.
But the most important, which is why I very rarely like to use the word culture as singular, because an organization doesn't have a culture. It has several cultures. You know, the salespeople can have one culture. The finance people can have a totally different culture. So there's a macro culture that the organization avows to or aspires to. And then there are all these little micro cultures, you know. So,
and hopefully they're all supporting one another with as little conflict as possible, or you've got people being pulled apart.
Well, that's not an ideal situation, but it's usually the other way around. I mean, there is a lot of conflict.
Yeah.
I mean, just take a look at the geography of the United States. I mean, people talk about Midwest. Well, Midwest doesn't mean that everybody from Oklahoma loves everybody from Nebraska, or they love everybody from Iowa. They all think that they have these very unique identities, and everybody else, we are the best, and everybody else is like out there in the boondocks.
Right, right. And the same with the East Coast and the West Coast.
Correct.
You know, yeah, everybody, their identities, their wants, their needs. And as you said, circling back to the beginning, you can't make everyone happy.
I think even trying to do it is delusional. I mean, it's just not possible.
And so having a way to deal with that, a consistent way to deal with that from, you know, this is how we look at that. We look at how do we support the maximum number? How do we benefit the greatest number?
Right.
Is you know, so we're right back to where we started our conversation today.
Really? I mean,
maximizing.
Yeah, and I'm not trying to sort of, you know, talk up my book or make it look better than it is, but I mean, there is a reason why it did resonate so strongly with both the readers and the reviewers, is because there are some fundamentals that don't go away, you know? And one of those fundamentals is that leadership is all about decision-making, and decision-making sacrifices something or someone. And who you sacrifice, why you sacrifice, what you sacrifice says a lot about you as a leader. End of story. I mean, yeah. I can make it a lot more complicated, but why? Why should I do it? No, the real right. complicated thing is what I would call, you know, scripting and navigating the leadership journey. Because as I said a little while ago, all leaders have a mandate. They inherit an organization at point A, and they're going to give it up at point B, because no leader is forever, not even the most despotic dictator on the planet. And then you've got to, you know, during that time, you have to then sort of navigate that leadership journey. You have to plot and chart the course that you're going to take. And that's really the essence of leadership.
Yep. And then you add people to the mix.
Oh, the people are in the mix, but they're on that ship, you know, that you're navigating. I mean, they are the ones making the noise and also saying, hey, we shouldn't be going north. We should be going east.
Exactly.
I mean, it's not like a one person saying, all right, I'm going to set the course and then sail on and land ahoy. There's no such thing like that. You know, everybody is charting a different course. And sometimes that's why you have these, you know, organizations spinning around in circles. I mean, as if they were in a whirlpool, because everybody's pulling in different directions.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, Garv, this has been great.
Thank you.
I loved the conversation. Is there anything that you would like to leave our listeners with?
No, just that I feel very strongly about the fact that our leaders are failing us more often than they are serving us. And I think leadership is not an entitlement. It's a privilege. And only when we start looking at it as a privilege that we realize that we owe more to the position than the position owes to us. And that's when we need a renaissance in leadership. There are tons of great leaders, but unfortunately, they're overshadowed by the tons of those who are not, you know. And we can pretend and be politically correct. I don't believe in political correctness. I believe it's a lie and a total waste of time. So I think that you know, in the interest of the greatest many, I think that we deserve. And sometimes we may have to blame for our own, for the leaders that we choose, because of the fact that we are not that stringent, we're not that rigorous in our choices, and we should be. We're not that demanding, and we should be. So it's really, you know, it's complex, it's interactive. But if I had a parting thought, it would be that leaders should be serving their constituencies more often than letting them down. That's all. And right now, I think it's the other way around.
Yeah. Well, thank you. And thank you for spending this time with me, sharing this. And I totally agree with you. And let's go out, and we are going to do what we can do.
Well, thank you very much.
So thank you.
Thanks for joining us this week on Leadership Reimagined. Now is the time to reimagine your leadership. Take a minute and go to reimagineyourleadership.com, and I'll call you. We'll have powerful conversations. You'll take action. Yes, there are always actions to take. Your business will expand, and I guarantee you'll have fun at the same time. I know, shouldn't it be fun? If it's not fun, why are you doing it?